So this first day of the retreat has been about breathing. And you've been breathing for a long time, since your beginning, kind of. I have been doing mindfulness of breathing for about 40 years. And I continue to find it interesting after 40 years. I find it more and more interesting as time goes along, rather than you think, you know, conventionally, like after a while you get the idea about breathing and you look at it for a while and you kind of get the basics. But I feel that, you know, I'm more learning more and more about life, about myself, about freedom, learning to tune into my breath, pay attention to my breath, be with my breath. It's just been a wonderful companion for me through my life, my breathing. There's a story of Gurdjieff, who was a Russian esoteric kind of mindfulness teacher, who, when he was kind of a new seeker, more or less, apparently went in 1910s, long ago, went off into the mountains of Afghanistan or Pakistan or somewhere to study with Sufi teachers. And he found his Sufi teacher, and teacher asked him, "Why are you here?" And Gurdjieff said, "I'm here to learn to breathe." And the teacher started laughing and then spent years, I guess, with the teacher learning how to breathe. Of course, he knew how to breathe, but learning to pay attention to breathing. So why is breathing so valuable to pay attention to? One reason is that I see it as a hub for so much of our life intersects or moves through our breathing. Much of our psychological life is connected to how we breathe, and much of our physical life is connected to how we breathe. You know, if you walk up a steep set of stairs, it affects your breathing. The mountain lion jumps at you, it affects your breathing. If you feel certain emotions, make you feel anxious, that affects your breathing. If you feel happy and safe, that affects your breathing. There's a very close relationship between the physical, emotional, psychological world, and I would say spiritual world as well. And I think there's no coincidence that the word spiritual has, from its Latin roots, the word breath in it. And as some of you know, I'm delighted that the expression spiritual inspiration has breath in both words. So here we are breathing. That's the topic for today. And that'll be the topic for the retreat, because we'll be doing this, the Buddha's instructions, 16-step instructions on mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out, anapanasati. One of the places where you see the significance the Buddha or the discourses give on this teaching on mindfulness of breathing is that it's one of the meditation teachings the Buddha taught his own son. Presumably when his son was a teenager, a good time for a father to teach his son is some meditation, he took his son aside and gave him a series of meditation instructions, ending with instructions on mindfulness of breathing. And he gave him the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing as the instructions. And then he said something very significant at the end of that. He said, "If you develop this well, then you'll be aware of your last breath as you die." And the tradition interprets that if you are present for your breathing as you die, and this kind of develop your mindfulness, your concentration, your calm, your ability to be present with the breath, that as you're there with your last breath, you'll die peacefully. And that's considered a good way to die. To have worked through the issues of your life, the fear, the anxieties, the desires, the hates, the remorse, the regrets, all the different things that have worked through them all, so that when you come to your final point of your life, that you can die peacefully. So it isn't that mindfulness of breathing in and of itself will help you to resolve these things and find some peace. But the process of developing mindfulness of breathing brings you into this hub, this nexus where so much of your life resides, that it'll support you and help you in this process of clarifying and resolving a lot. In 1979, I was standing on a path outdoors on a farm, and telling a friend of mine, who was a Zen practitioner, about a family difficulty my family was having. One of my family members was having quite a bit of health problems, was hospitalized, and didn't know if she was going to make it or whatever. And he listened to me and talked to me for about 10 minutes. And in those 10 minutes, he conveyed so much for compassion, about compassion towards me. I learned about compassion and how he tended to me during those 10 minutes that I've remembered ever since. And now that this man is dying, I'm filled with that memory of his compassion he had for me. And today I read a story about his passing away. I mean, he hasn't died yet. But I've known this, but today there was a new piece to the story. So 3 weeks ago, he was happy and fine, healthy, very robust man, healthy man. And suddenly started feeling pains, got diagnosed very quickly as having a terminal illness, and had a lot of pain, was hospitalized, and within a couple of weeks, I guess, they decided that there was really nothing they could do except manage his pain. And so then once they could manage the pain well enough, they'd send him home for hospice. Well, today he got news that they're sending him home, and he was very happy to be able to go home. And then he said something like, tomorrow will be 3 weeks since I got my new life. I've learned so much. Isn't that something? So he's going home to do hospice at home. And boy, 3 weeks ago I started my new life, and I've learned so much. That's quite something, to have that ability, that capacity to face that kind of issue in one's life and have that as a response. And there was a photograph next to the blog this is talked about. And he's in his bed with the hospital gown on and stubble beard and, you know, unkept the way you would be if you're in the hospital for a while, I guess. And he has this big smile. Not just a smile, but he's kind of radiant. So, mindfulness of breathing, meditation, coming on retreat. There's a second place where the Buddha teaches the 16 stages of mindfulness of breathing, and that is an occasion that's where the description of the occasion, at least if you can let your imagination kind of go with the description, I think it's quite beautiful. Quite meaningful. The way it's described is that the Buddha is together with a gathering of monks, a fairly large gathering, maybe several hundred, in what was probably a very large park in the outskirts of a capital city in ancient India, where one of the local aristocrats, royalty, had given him a small, probably a palace, and the park that around the palace to be a monastery. And they'd gathered there for what's known as the rains retreat, where they come and gather and practice for 3 months in the fall. And they gathered together on a full moon night. And the text describes it being a full moon night. And I can imagine, India and the fall and clear skies and this beautiful full moon and forested park, a forested grove of trees, and this large gathering of monks around. And the Buddha says to the gathered monks, he says, more or less, you've been practicing now for 3 months. This is great. but don't let up. I'm going to stay here another month with you so that you guys can keep practicing and to keep going deeper into this practice. So he does, and they do, and then they describes the next full moon, and then the Buddha expresses his pleasure, his delight or satisfaction that everyone's practicing, and he describes the different groups of monastics who are practicing and how they different ones practice different practices. There's not just one practice that fits everyone, but that there are different choices and practices you can do, and hopefully you find the one that's most suited for you. But then he ends with a description of the last practice, which is the 16 stages of mindfulness of breathing. And the way it's set up, the text, it's kind of like, yeah, those are all really great practices, but let me tell you about, let me really tell you about mindfulness of breathing. So I think it's kind of giving it some prominence. And then he says, I'll read it to you. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. When the seven factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and liberation. That's nice. So it's held up as being very effective, this practice, bringing great fruit to focus on mindfulness of breathing. And I know from my own experience that when you're relatively new to this or not so new to it, there comes times when you can't imagine how concentrating the breath can be useful for anybody, especially for you. I have a particular label that I use for myself for a particular feeling of how the breath can be sometimes. I call it cardboard breath. It's just completely, unpleasant in this kind of cardboardy way. You know, it's completely uninteresting and bland and, you know, nothing at all. And, just what's this big deal about this physical, you know, the air goes in, air goes out, you've done that, mastered that, what's next? It just doesn't, you know, what is it about the breathing? So I know that we can have that feeling and not feel any connection to it being valuable. And if you come to that, I suggest you just take it as a phase. Don't believe it. It's really good to learn to be careful about what you believe that your mind tells you. Most people don't have a tremendously good track record at coming up with a lot of constantly true ideas in their mind. So it's good to learn how to hold what comes up in the mind lightly. And so if you're feeling not so connected to the breath, you wonder what's all about this first day, just take it as a phase and just continue with the practice. It opens up at some point. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the first stages of these 16 steps, the first four steps in it. And the first four, called the first tetrad, is connected to mindfulness of the body. The second tetrad is connected to the second foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of feelings, feeling tones. The third tetrad is connected to mindfulness of the mind, the third foundation of mindfulness. And the last four is connected to mindfulness of the dharmas, the last foundation of mindfulness. So today we'll focus a little bit on this foundation of the body, and there's four practices, four steps in this that it describes. The first is it says, when you're breathing in a long breath, know you're breathing in a long breath. When you're breathing out a long breath, know you're breathing out a long breath. That's all it says for the first step. It does say something preliminary before doing that. Maybe it's worth reading. Having gone to the forest, so if you look out the window, we're here, good enough. Having gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty room, sit down and fold your legs crosswise. Sit with your body erect and establish mindfulness. Ever mindful, one breathes in. Ever mindful, one should breathe out. So this idea of first establishing mindfulness. My favorite translation from the sati is not mindfulness, but rather awareness. Establish your awareness. Establish your presence here. This is where you want to be for the unfolding of the practice. You don't want to be back in what happened at work or somewhere else last week. You don't want to be the plans of the future, what's going to be. You want to somehow ground yourself in what's happening here and now. And sometimes what I do in my practice when my mind is very busy and I can't get here, I will say the word here, H-E-R-E, not as a command to a dog, but rather as a gentle reminder that I'm here. And it's a very permissive here, because nothing has to be any different. It's just a reminder, I am here now. And then I say the word, and then I just notice, I kind of like I open my eyes metaphorically in meditation, and just notice, well, what is here? So if I'm thinking about the past, I say here, and then I notice, I don't berate myself for thinking about the past, I just notice here there's a person who's thinking about the past. This is what it's like to be thinking about the past. And when I shift the focus from thinking about the past to noticing how it's something that's happening in the present moment, the trance, the glue that keeps me thinking about those thoughts begins to loosen. And so I begin to kind of, and then if I think about the future, or if I'm just kind of spinning around crazy in my mind, I'll just say here, and kind of like with permission, open up, and what's this like? It's like this now. And again, that begins breaking the trance of whatever I'm preoccupied and caught by, or the energy of being caught or involved in something. And slowly, the energy of being caught or being preoccupied begins to abate, slow down. And at some point, I find I'm able to stay in the present moment a little bit better than I did before. And at that point, then my capacity to be aware and present is little bit established, and so then I'll turn my attention to breathing, take in the experience of breathing. And so the text says, when you breathe in a long breath, know you're breathing in a long breath. When you're breathing out a long breath, know you're breathing out a long breath. Because the next step in this 16-step sequence is so closely connected to the first one, I'll tell you that as well. When you're breathing in a short breath, know you're breathing in a short breath. When you're breathing out a short breath, know you're breathing out a short breath. This is not rocket science. This is not, you know, asking you to do a complicated psychological or spiritual gymnastics to, you know. And in fact, some people don't have the patience for such simple instruction, because they're here for spiritual glory, whatever that might be, or to resolve important issues in their lives. And this, like, what does this long and short breath have to do with anything? I take this instructions as shorthand for begin to notice what your experience of breathing is like. What's the actual experience of breathing? What goes on? What do you experience when you tune into it? And there's a lot more you could know. You could know certainly whether your breathing is short or long. You can know whether it's shallow or deep. You could know some of the sensations connected to it. You can know whether there's You can know contraction and expansion. You can know tightness and looseness. You can know feelings of smoothness, relaxation. You can know feelings of roughness. Sometimes the breathing can feel kind of rough. You can know tingling. You can know warmth and coolness. You can know pressure and the release of the pressure. There's a whole slew of different sensations that come into play as we're breathing. And I was taught vipassana, mindfulness meditation, was to get interested in those details. That does a number of things. Those details of the immediate experience of breathing is something that's happening in the present moment. So if we're trying to do is to train ourselves to be present, this becomes the place where we do that training. And it doesn't have to be that interesting for you to get the benefit of developing the muscle to stay present and be here. So the mind wanders off and you come back. Mind wanders off and you come back. And every time the mind wanders off in thought and you let go, you're letting go of your rumination, your preoccupation, but more importantly, you're letting go of some of the energy or fuel that gets you preoccupied. You're weakening that muscle of preoccupation. And if you do that enough times, slowly, incrementally, you weaken that pull that pulls you away. And slowly you begin to kind of settle in to be here. This happens even more so on retreat, because one of the advantages of being on a retreat like this is that you do not have a lot of new input into your life. So you don't have a lot of conversations, you're not checking email, you are not watching TV, you're not doing the news. And so when there's a lot less input coming in, we're not refueling the tendency to be preoccupied and caught up. And so slowly, that because we're not refueling it, things begin to settle. And this coming back and training ourselves on the breath, slowly we find ourselves actually able to stay more and more in the present moment. But there's more interesting things than other interesting things that happen with mindfulness of breathing. And one of the ways to talk about this is that one of the primary things we're trying to do in mindfulness is to just notice what is actually happening. We're not trying in and of itself to have great states of concentration, great states of bliss, great states of insight. We're just trying to notice in a direct way, simple way, what's happening right now. And so, certainly the breathing is happening, but all kinds of things are happening in the present moment. And the effort to try to stay with the breath begins to highlight other things that go on. And the analogy I like to give for this is that of if there's a mountain stream. I came up with this analogy at Vajrapani when we were teaching up in the mountains in Boulder Creek, and they had a little creek. There's very still river, creek, that's so still and so clear and that you can't tell if there's a current, if the water is flowing. But if you take a stick and put it in vertically into the water, then a little wake gets formed on the edge of the stick. And you see, in fact, that there's a current. But without that reference point of the stick, you won't see the current. So the same way in our lives, if you have a reference point for the currents of your mind, currents of your heart, then you can see much more clearly what's going on there that you can't see if you don't have that reference point, if you're just kind of flowing along with it. And the reference point is mindfulness of breathing. Your attempt to come back to your breath and try to stay there shows you that you can't. shows you that your mind has a mind of its own, that it's thinking a lot. And you probably, you can go about your life quite happily, distracted, caught up in your thoughts, not thinking twice about it, just that's the way things are. And you don't know how powerful the grip is of your thinking mind. But if you sit down here to meditate and try to stay with your breath, most of you probably by now have a pretty good sense of the grip that your thinking mind has on you, how quick and easy it is to wander off into your thoughts. It's not a mistake that this is happening, that you see this. This is the beginning of insight. You're beginning to see something about yourself. You should be congratulating yourself for seeing that the mind can't get concentrated. Look at that. Isn't that interesting? You're learning new things. 3 weeks ago, I had my new life, and I'm learning something new every day, my friend said as he was dying. 2 minutes ago, I tried to stay with my breath, and I've learned so much in these 2 minutes. I've learned that my mind is out of control. And I emphasize this because it's so common for people to berate themselves for not succeeding in doing what they set themselves to do. If the instructions is follow the breath, a common way of interpreting that is, I better do it right. And if I don't do it, I must be doing it wrong, and therefore I am an inadequate meditator. But that's not the way this meditation kind of works on a different kind of logic, I suppose, than conventional minds work. And I like to say that mindfulness of breathing works also when it doesn't work. It works when it works, and it works when it doesn't work. So this is what I mean. It works when it works, when you can stay on your breath, stay focused, stay present, get concentrated, the mind gets quiet, you're able to stay in the present moment with the breath. You ride the breath. You're going to ride it like you're riding a wave or something, just stay there with it. Or like an eagle riding the updrafts, the attention kind of rides the sensations of breathing and breathing in, breathing out, kind of like you have great wings and just riding it. And you've caught it and feel so good, caught the updraft. So then it works. It's nice. It works when it doesn't work because when it doesn't work, it means that you weren't able to stay with the breath. But that's okay because that's not the point, to stay with the breath. The point is to notice what's happening. So if the attempt to try to be with the breath shows you that you can't be with the breath very well, if the attempt to be with the breath shows you not only that, but shows you what is going on in a clearer way, then it works. So you might notice, I'm thinking about the past a lot. I'm ruminating. Or if you want to kind of take some of the trance out of your preoccupations, call it regurgitation. That's what cows do, right? When they ruminate. So, or I'm thinking about the future, or there's very strong emotions coming up that I'm riding and involved in that pull me away. Or there's other things that are going on. And you see it perhaps more clearly, some of these things, because of this reference point of breathing you're trying to do. So you don't need to berate yourself, just get curious. You're learning new things. Wow, this is how it works. This is what goes on in my mind. And then you might say the word here. As a reminder, you don't have to stop doing what you're doing. You don't have to say, but rather, you want to step out of its trance, out of the preoccupation, step away and look at it. This is how it is now. This is what's going on now. See it. And then, and seeing it, you can come back to the breath. So you might see how you're preoccupied. You also, one of the things, sooner or later, one of the nice ways that mindfulness of breathing works is you can start seeing the expectations you have with the practice itself. So, you know, you might have come here having learned a little bit about Buddhism and meditation, and expecting that you would, this is a good retreat, and this is your chance, and, you know, certainly by the second day, or the end of the first day, you'll be in the first jhana, and since it's only a 7-day retreat, you know, it's one jhana up one's the scale, and you have to kind of you know, one of these days you're going to have to kind of bump it up two to get to the eighth by the end. And so the first day has to at least be the first. And you know, at the end of the first day, you're not close. You know, you don't even know, you know, what, you know, what planet you're on. The mind is so tired and agitated or something. So then you might notice that you keep coming back, and you notice the mind keeps having these thoughts, expectations about getting concentrated, or getting mindful, or resolving issues in your life, or all kinds of things. Or you might notice your relationship to failure. That's a wonderful thing to learn. How you relate to not succeeding. It could be one of the best things that happened on this retreat for you is you fail utterly to stay with your breath. You try to stay with it, and you fail. And you learn that when you tend to fail, you get disappointed, you get angry, you start blaming others, you blame the teachers. That's a good one. And or you blame the facilities, or, you know, and so your strategy is, you know, I'm kind of like the ostrich strategy myself, you know, I bury my head in the sand. So you know, you see what you do when the so-called failure happens. Your relationship to not succeeding at what you want to do, what you're trying to do. Do you tell yourself stories? Do you relate it to your self-identity? And one of the ways to relate it to self-identity is something like, I've done this, you know, I can't go and meet with my teacher because I can't report this. You know, I'm supposed to report, you know, something wonderful. So what I'm trying to convey to you is the simplicity of just coming back to your breath, being with your breath, tuning into the breath, learning about the breath. This simplicity, breathing in long, knowing I breathe in long, breathing out long, knowing I breathe out long, just keeping it as simple as possible has a lot of benefits. It has a benefit of maybe you'll develop concentration and mindfulness and presence and being here. I think you'll develop much more than you have when you came the first day. You'll learn a lot about yourself in that process. You'll learn where you are, what's going on for you. You'll learn about your expectations, the agendas you bring, the judgments you bring, the spiritual ideas you have of what's supposed to happen, all your supposed tos. Sometimes people don't realize how much they operate on supposed tos, should. I should be this way, this should be happening. And then to see these inner voices and of authority that we kind of drive our life, they begin to kind of be flushed out and revealed in this very simple process of keeping it simple. One of the things to discover is the voice that screams, it can't be this simple. It can't be this simple. It has to be more sophisticated. I'm a sophisticated person, and this is ridiculous. So keep it simple. It's really helpful. In fact, one of the great teachers in our particular tradition, a man named Munindra, the teacher of Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and other people, he had a little saying that if it's not simple, it's not mindfulness. So if you're trying to figure it out, what am I supposed to do now? Remember, it's supposed to be simple. Relax. You're always breathing, so just come back to your breathing. Take a deep breath, come back. And then when I had my traveler's check stolen in Calcutta, I went to Munindra, because I was staying at his temple, and went to see him, and I told him about my traveler's checks being stolen, and he looked at me very kindly and said, Gil, you should be simple, but don't be a simpleton. So then, we stay, you can stay for a long time with those first two steps. In fact, I've stayed for 40 years, coming back to my breath, being with my breath, using the breath as a foundation for my practice. It's the primary meditation practice I do, is staying with my breath. And it's kind of off, because I do it so often, it's been so much a big part of my life. It's kind of always there for me. Not always, but you know, often. It's kind of like there in the background. I'm aware of my breathing. I tune into my breath. I'm in conversations with people. I notice sometimes how I'm breathing, what's going on. Sitting up here talking to you, I'm connected to my breathing and tracking how my breath is. And it's valuable because as my breathing shifts and changes, it tells me something about what's going on with me. If my breathing starts getting constricted or held, that's interesting to learn. Usually when my breathing gets held, that's a sign that I'm caught in something. So then I question, do I want to stay caught? Is this being held and tight appropriate? Or do I relax? Let go of the belly that's being held in or the chest that's held in. And so it's very helpful for me as I go through my life to come back and stay connected to my breath, be familiar with my breathing, and to be able to notice the shifts and changes that go on. As we continue this practice, at some point, the sense of presence, being connected, being quieter, being here, starts to grow. And at some point, then we can then take the next step. Sometimes it happens naturally, just on its own. And that is, breathing in, we experience our whole body. Breathing out, one experiences one's whole body. And this idea of experiencing one's body, the whole body is the word, expression. One of the surprises for me in being a Buddhist practitioner is the emphasis that Buddhism puts on being embodied, being connected to the body. And as much as I love my breathing now, I also love being connected to my body, being in my body. The sense of being embodied and aware of what's going on in my body, I feel like it's like my great refuge or great support or my great teacher, my body, because how much I learn from it and stay connected to it. And so, so part of the training in Buddhism, very important part of the training, is to start really living in your body, noticing what's going on, develop the skill, the capacity, the interest to regularly tune in to what's happening in the sensations of the body. What parts of your body are activated, are energized at particular times? Where is the tension in your body? What are the sensations that are operating in the body? The more you can be connected to your embodied experience, the more that becomes a really good foundation for everything else you're going to do in Buddhism, Buddhist practice. Supports it. So much so that I liken it to the foundation of a pyramid. If a pyramid has a good foundation, it's stable. But if you take the pyramid upside down and put it on its top, the pointy top, it'll topple over. So the body is the good base. On top of the base of the body is the next layer of the pyramid is our emotions. Our emotions are much more, we can be much wiser and more stable to be with our emotional life if we're rooted in our body. And then on top of that, the peak of the pyramid is our thinking mind. And our thinking mind is kind of insecure, so it's good to put it on top. But then it has the stability of the body and the emotions that gives the thinking some stability. But if you turn it upside down and try to live based on your thinking only, then you're like a pyramid upside down and you'll topple over regularly. So this, you know, mindfulness of the body, being connected to your body, looking for all kinds of opportunities to drop in and feel what's going on. Standing in the meal line, it's a great place to do mindfulness of the body. It's much better than, looking at what everybody else is getting on their plates and then judging them. You know, how could that person take so little? They should eat more. How could they take so much? You know, we're on retreat. We shouldn't eat so much on retreat. Or, you know, look at that. They took you know, they took more mushrooms than anybody else. You know, don't they know that I want mushrooms too? So you could do that kind of thinking. Or you could not be involved in looking at what people are getting and stay and feel your feet firmly on the ground. Feel your body, the substance, the weight of your body standing there. And just feel, kind of come, get curious, get interested in this wonderful thing that we have called the body, the human body. Because it's the repetition of training oneself, coming back to the body, coming back over and over again, where we begin to wake up in the body, wake up through the body, becomes alive and becomes familiar to us, becomes something that we can recognize what's going on. And so breathing in, experiencing the whole body, breathing out, experiencing the whole body. So the, you know, in this kind of practice, it's like continue to breathe, keep the breathing going like at the center or something, and then open the awareness up and be aware of what's going on in the rest of your body as you breathe. Breathe with the body. As you sit here, sensations will arise, sometimes discomfort. Breathe with them. There's something very useful about breathing with. Breathing is a lubricant. If you can stay with the rhythm of breathing, breathing in, breathing out, it's a little harder for the mind to get fixated and caught in something. So if you can just stay with the breathing, keep the mind lubricated, keep it soft, keep things light. Just breathe in, breathing out, stay with it. And then breathe with the pain that you have. Don't breathe against it. Don't get caught in it. Just breathe with it. Stay loose with it if you can. Breathe with a sense of the whole body breathing. One of the great experiences is like kind of like your whole torso is like bellows, or like Richard talked about a balloon. It expands and contracts. Just kind of feel the wholeness of it moving in and out. Sit here and kind of see if you can open your attention wide so that you feel the fullness of the body as you breathe. The mind has a capacity to get contracted and constricted, cut up in particular things, or being very fixated on like the breath or something. It's really helpful sometimes to open up and experience the full body, and in the midst of this full body breathe. Breathe in and breathe out. It's like the grounding, or it's like the stability, or it's like the it's the in the middle of it all. As we begin to become more aware of the body, which will happen on its own if you're on retreat like this, you don't have to do anything intentional. Sooner or later, what you'll notice is tension in your body. Holding patterns in your body. And these holding tension and holding patterns in the body that we have are there because of our psychology, generally. It's there because of what the mind or emotions or desires and aversions are doing. If some people, when they get afraid or anxious, their shoulders goes up. It isn't that the shoulders are not doing that by themselves, independent of you, but rather there's some kind of thoughts that are going on. I could be sitting peacefully, enjoying myself, relaxed and happy, and then I can remember that before I came on retreat, I got a letter from the California Tax Franchise Office. There's a problem, they tell me. And then I could feel my stomach grip. All my wealth is going to go. They want it all. And so the gripping of my stomach is not because my stomach just likes to grip, but I have these thoughts. It's fascinating to watch the arising of those particular thoughts, memories, ideas, and then see how the involvement in those thoughts translates to what the body does. Tension, holding, and all that. And what's kind of sad is when small tension holding goes on, are done chronically over and over and over again, how much tension builds up over over time. You know, it can be something as simple as driving on the freeway for half an hour. Maybe you're driving a little bit more faster than you need to, so you're a little bit more tense and gripping. And it could seem like from one moment to the next, that a little bit of gripping of the steering wheel and pushing and leaning forward and making your way through the traffic, you know, it's you have plenty of resilience, you have plenty of capacity to do all kinds of things. But to do that for half an hour or an hour, however long, and continues keeping that strain on this on the body, then by the time we get where we're going, it takes a while for that to dissipate because it's held and the momentum is there. When we come on retreat, we start noticing the impact or the holding in the body of the momentum of how we've lived our life. And there's layers of it. So the tension you built up driving here over 17, hopefully that dissipated fairly quickly once you got here. But there are the tension you've carried with you over a lifetime because you're always protecting yourself from imminent danger. That anywhere you go, that's you think, you know, maybe you didn't even know that you thought that way, that was underneath here. But as you sit on retreat and get quieter and quieter, sometimes we start seeing the undercurrents of how we think, how we operate. It's not uncommon for people to come to a meditation teacher's on retreat and come with big kind of eyes of surprise and say, I had no idea how pervasive fear was for me. It's there all the time. I had no idea. Or how pervasive anger was, aversion. It's always there. I had no idea because, you know, I hadn't gotten quiet enough to see it's an undercurrent that kind of informs everything. And that's interesting to see. 3 weeks ago, I started a new life, and I learned so much. So that, I'm saying, you know, yesterday you started a new retreat, and I learned so much. What did you learn? I learned I have lots of aversion. Wow, isn't that great? I learned a lot. So we learn how it is. And it's good to learn. Don't berate yourself. Don't feel bad about what you gets uncovered. And so we have these layers and layers, and that layers of undercurrents is also layers of tension, holding patterns in our body. And so as we settled in, some of the obvious tensions in our body might relax after a day or two, but then we have a chance to discover deeper tensions. And some tension that we carry that's chronic, they say that chronically tense muscles go numb. And as we begin to relax and open up and wake up those areas of our body, they start to hurt. And I know I've had the experience on retreat where this happened, and my first thought was, I'm getting really tense. I'm going backwards. I came here to relax, and now I'm getting more tense. I'm a meditation failure. But it isn't that. Rather, what's happening is that actually I'm continuing to unwind, but the unwinding reveals tension that I didn't know that I had. So now I feel tenser than I was before, but actually I'm not tenser. It's actually part of the settling, unwinding process. So we start noticing as we sit here and get quiet and tune in and just be simple and just hear. Sooner or later, we notice more and more of our body. And as we know more of our body, we start noticing the tension, the holding patterns of our body. These tension and holding patterns in our body are called, in this tradition, the bodily formations. Those parts of our bodily experience that's formed or created by what our psychology does, what our mind does. And and some of that, you know, is intention and holding patterns of different kinds. Some of them are benign, these things that come, and some are not so benign. But the bodily formations. So then the last step in these first four steps of Anapanasati is breathing in. One relaxes the bodily formations. Breathing out, one relaxes the bodily formations. I think maybe a more technically accurate translation is one tranquilizes the bodily formations, but relaxes the bodily formations. So this emphasis on relaxing. Richard started that this morning, relaxing. So useful to relax. Tune in to where notice where there's tension and holding, and relax without losing your uprightness. Because you know you can relax and become a puddle, you know. But to stay upright and then let anything that's not needed relax and to soften. And I know it's not easy to relax the tension, the holding in the body, but it's at least good to know you have permission to do it. That's a part of the practice, is to allow yourself to be at ease and relax. Particularly important for people who strain in doing the practice, pushing and demanding and wanting and trying to get someplace, and you don't have to get anywhere. You know, looking at their watch, am I there yet? Actually, you should look at your watch and say, yes, I am there. I'm here. If you have a watch, a good thing to do on retreat with a wristwatch is periodically look at your watch. You know, something happens on the retreat. You have a feeling, something, you have thoughts, whatever, no matter what. You have a pain, the oatmeal is burnt, whatever. You know, something show up and there's no oatmeal, whatever. Just look at your watch and say, right on time. Right on time. Whenever something happens on the retreat that you think this shouldn't be happening, this is not good news. I wish it wasn't like this. Right on time. It's a much better strategy than some of the alternatives. So the idea is to be accepting of what is. Accepting, kind of at ease with what is. So this relaxing the bodily formations. See if you can be at ease with what is. Be at ease with yourself. Be at ease with your challenges. Be at ease with the challenges of being here. Relax. It's such a useful thing because as we begin to find ease and relaxation with everything, ease and relaxation with the challenges that we have, it's easier for the mind to develop its mindfulness. It's easier to kind of develop a capacity to be present. It's easier to see clearly when you're at ease and relaxed. It's easier to get concentrated if you're at ease and relaxed. So, the first two steps, be really simple with your breathing. Just notice, tune into your breath. Become really familiar with your breath. Imagine that you're a naturalist from Mars and you're able to get inside of a human being. You've never seen a human being before. And for some reason, they put you on the diaphragm. That's your assignment from Mars. And you have to kind of really discover, what's this human experience like of breathing like, so you can write field notes and go back to Mars and tell them what happens. Get curious, get familiar. What's your experience of breathing? Like you've never known your breath before. Get into it. And then as you get into your breathing and able to stay a little bit more with your breath, open up to your body. Keep breathing, but kind of notice the rest of your body. Broad, open awareness. Breathing in, experience the whole body. Breathing out, experience the whole body. And then, breathing in, relax your body. Breathing out, soften the body. I find it particularly useful to do this on the exhale, as I exhale to relax, to soften, to let go. So, I know from my own experience and from being a teacher for a long time that the first day of the retreat is often difficult. Tiredness, body aches, restless mind, all kinds of things. Be at ease with the difficulty. It's okay. Don't take it personally. Don't make grand conclusions about the meaning of life for you or something or the retreat based on what happens the first day. Try to be gracious. Try to be generous to yourself and the experience. Just go along. Do your best you can. Go along. And always fall back that the basic thing we're trying to do, just know what's happening. If you know what's happening, you're doing the practice. If you know you have a headache, just know then you're doing the practice. It's okay. Whatever's going on. Keep it simple. So I have a couple of announcements. And for today, we have now posted the list of names of who's going to have a practice discussion with Richard and I tomorrow. And we're going to see half of you tomorrow and half of you the next day. So if you don't see your name on the list for tomorrow, know your name will appear on the list tomorrow. So, if you're not sure where the rooms are, we'll explain that in the morning where you're going to be. But right now I'm going to tell you that the list of people and the times and the room you go to, one is on the dining room door. On the left-hand door, you'll see a sheet of paper up. And also a second copy is up here on the wall across from the drinking fountain. And this evening, we have a meditation session in here at 7:45. And at the end of that period, Richard and I would like to have a little question and answer period with you, if you have questions about the practice or being here, but mostly about the practice, your experience. But we'd like to do it this way, that if you have a question for us, if you can leave that on a note on the bulletin board downstairs. And then Richard and I, with our infinite wisdom, each of us will choose one of those questions. And so please, I don't know how many people will, but if more than two people leave questions, please, be okay with the fact that we only have time to do two. And so then at the end of that 7:45 sitting, we'll end a few minutes early, and each of us will take our question and read it and respond here. So we can better support you here. So that's the plan. Okay, so thank you very much, and please enjoy the rest of the day.